The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, September 1st, 2016.
Donald Trump saying there could be some softening.
He could see a softening, to use his word, of his policy.
Possible softening of his controversial position.
For the past 2 weeks, that he could go in a number of different directions.
Mr. President, I want to thank you. It's been a tremendous honor. And I call you a friend. And they are amazing people, amazing people.
Before his speech on securing the border, a trip across it.
We did discuss the wall. We didn't discuss payment of the wall. That'll be for a later date.
Peña Nieto took to Twitter to disagree, writing, "At the beginning of the conversation with Donald Trump, I made it clear Mexico will not pay for the wall."
We will build a great wall along the southern border, and Mexico will pay for the wall. And you can call it deported if you want. The press doesn't like that term. You can call it whatever the hell you want. They're gone. Within ICE, I am going to create a new special deportation task force focused on identifying and quickly removing the most dangerous criminal illegal immigrants in America who have evaded justice, just like Hillary Clinton has evaded justice, okay? Maybe they'll be able to deport her. Wall, are you ready? Impenetrable, physical, powerful, tall, beautiful southern border wall.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening. Wednesday, yet another day dominated by Donald Trump. In the morning, an impromptu trip to Mexico, America's neighbor that feels insulted and vilified by his rhetoric about its people on the campaign trail. By night, to Phoenix for a policy speech on immigration, the number one issue to his base and the biggest issue driving Republican politics today. What did we learn? Well, the wall, not an electronic one, not one made out of sensors and drones, but a big, tall, beautiful wall, as Trump put it, is still his plan. And Donald Trump is still, despite what his own staffers have sometimes said, taking a very hard line on immigration. For reaction both to Trump's whirlwind immigration Wednesday and the policies embedded in it, Ricardo Perez Gonzalez, he's a permanent legal resident of the United States and a citizen of Mexico. He lives and works in Minneapolis. Hi, Ricardo.
Hello.
And back on The Takeaway, Elise Foley, immigration and politics reporter with The Huffington Post. Hi, Elise.
Hi.
Ricardo, let me start with you. What did you hear in Donald Trump's speech yesterday? I know you watched it. What did you take away from it?
I felt that he was very energetic, that he was very he had an agenda and he went through it. And I mean, it was pretty scary.
Did you detect any real difference, Ricardo, from, let's say, the immigration rhetoric back at the Republican convention? There has been talk of softening, of moderating his tone, and I wonder what you took away from the Phoenix speech last night.
He's kind of trying to back up a little bit from Mexican people. He went to Mexico. You know, I feel like they're trying to make the enemy someone else but Mexican people. They're now saying that it's Central American people, the ones that are responsible for most of the illegal immigration. But this time he seemed like he had more of a plan. He had some points that he wanted to like talk about, like 10 points or something like that. So it seems like, yeah, he's trying to tone it down. He's trying to put more structure in his ideas. But everything that he's saying, it's already on the law. It's already on the books. Immigration is already extremely tough. So to me, he's not saying anything new, but he continues to target people to make a point about his stand. So
Elise Foley, so many people have spent the last 10 days or 2 weeks looking for this softening, this moderation in Trump's tone, because he himself has said that it might be coming. The point here is that the hard line of the Republican primary isn't selling well in a general election. And I wonder what you took away from the speech yesterday.
Well, I think that what happened is that before he was letting people sort of fill in the blanks. So he'd say vaguely that there might be softening. He'd say things that indicated that he was maybe willing to think about some undocumented people as not being vicious criminals. And people filled in the blanks and thought, okay, well, if he's talking about being humane, that must mean that he thinks of humane in a similar way that they do. And I think what happened last night is he actually had to lay out, or didn't have to, decided to lay out some specific policy positions and made it clear that what he thinks of as fair and humane is something that is closer to the mass deportations that we were hearing about in the primary.
Well, let's play Trump in his own words, at least, because this is an important part of the policy that people have been wanting to hear from Donald Trump on ever since in the primary he criticized other candidates for advocating for something less than deportation, which, of course, he called amnesty. Listen.
As with any law enforcement activity, we will set priorities. But unlike this administration, no one will be immune or exempt from enforcement. And ICE and Border Patrol officers will be allowed to do their jobs the way their jobs are supposed to be done.
Elise, this felt to me like a punt on the issue of deportation. We're going to prioritize, like all law enforcement does, but no one's immune. We can get anyone at any time, and you don't really know exactly what the policy is.
I don't think it's necessarily a punt, actually. I think that that is just sort of the way it works.
It is the way it works in the real world, but it hasn't been the expectation of his voting base so far.
No, that's true. I mean, he's presented an unrealistic picture of what he can do. And, you know, he's presented that he would manage to do this because he's such a great manager. He's, you know, able to do all these things other people wouldn't. Now he's sort of backing off from that and, you know, presenting a picture that's more realistic.
Ricardo?
But to me, he did make it sound that like law enforcement has been held back from his duties. But when he starts, then he's going to let him go. He's going to let him do their job because right now they are unable to do their job because of some reason. So to me, like, he's continuing to use fear and he's continuing to targeting Latinos, like Mexican people, saying, when I'm in command, the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to let him go. They're going to come and get you. They're going to kick you out. And his rhetoric has always been to target, like, the families of the people that are, quote-unquote, supposedly criminals as well. So he's not only targeting those people that could have been or that could be criminals or whatever, but he's also targeting their families. So to me, again, he's using fear to manipulate people. So that's what it sounded to me many times.
Elise Foley, I was struck also by the emphasis that Trump placed on what are called angel moms, angel families. These are the families of people who were killed by criminal illegal immigrants, people who should not have been in this country. And we'd have a great deal of sympathy for these people. But in the end, he brought them up on the stage. And the message seemed to be that immigration is an issue of people's mortal safety. You could be killed if these people aren't kicked out of the country, not an issue of economic policy or migration policy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he mentioned things like immigrants taking welfare and immigrants taking jobs, but that was his main focus, is this idea that, you know, there is potential at all times that you could be killed by an, you know, undocumented person. And I think it's understandable to find that idea frustrating. And obviously, as you said, you know, we have a lot of sympathy for these families, and I can see why they're frustrated. But at the same time, it is definitely cherry-picking the worst of the worst. I understand why he's doing it, but he's emphasizing criminal element over the vast majority of undocumented people in a way that allows him, or he thinks allows him, to just ignore the undocumented people who are dreamers, who have been here since they were kids, or who've lived here for 25 years and, you know, have no other violations than immigration violations.
Ricardo, your business deals a lot with the Hispanic community there in Minneapolis. You're in the business of bone marrow matching with donors and recipients. What are your clients saying when they talk about the election?
People are afraid. I know a lot of people that are going through the process of becoming citizens so they can vote, which I'm very proud of. But people are fed up. They're tired of you know, being constantly on the news, because when they're referring to Mexican people, they're not referring to only a specific segment of Mexican people, they're referring to every single Mexican person that lives in the U.S. and also non-Mexican people, because we all fall under that umbrella.
And Elise, it's important to point out on policy grounds that Donald Trump made clear that no one who is here illegally can have any pathway to normalization. You have to leave. There is no path to legal status if you came here illegally.
Right. He said that the only way that you could get legal status is by going back to your native country and then going through another, you know, the legal immigration process. And he actually talked about making the legal immigration process quite possibly harder. So it's hard to see why anybody would have a strong incentive to go through that. I mean, it seems like there would be a very real possibility that someone would go back to their native country and not be able to come back to the U.S. And so I think that what I took away from that is that he would likely advocate some sort of legal immigration policy where you didn't let in maybe somebody who was poor but was related to somebody already living in the U.S., and you would let in only people who might create jobs instead. And that would be really fundamentally changing sort of the way the U.S. has done immigration for years.
And so, Elise, we have talked about, you and I on this show, the political bridge that Donald Trump has to cross here, the hardline immigration stance of a Republican primary, the difference between that and getting 65 million votes in a general election with changing demographics. What do we know now after Donald Trump's speech last night about if or how he's going to do that?
I mean, it seems that he is going to try to win as many white votes as possible and then Latino votes not worry too much about it. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion of Mitt Romney, how poorly he did with Latino voters. That's been attributed many, many times to the fact that he talked about self-deportation and that, you know, it inspired Latino voters to go out and vote against him. I think it's pretty obvious that that is going to happen this year. And I think that it looks like he will do even worse with Latino voters. And I think it's not just Latinos. I mean, there are undocumented people who are Asian, certainly Asian immigrants. The way he talks about, obviously, black people. I mean, I think that right now he's really doubling down on trying to win as many white people as possible and not worrying about whether he's going to turn the rest, inspire the rest to go out and vote for him, even if maybe they wouldn't have voted otherwise.
This election has been different than others in so many ways, but Mitt Romney lost Latino voters by 38 points, and Republicans after that said that has to change or they can't win. Well, it's not really changing. In fact, it may be getting worse from the political perspective. Elise Foley, immigration and politics reporter for Huffington Post. Thanks, Elise.
Thank you.
Also, Ricardo Perez-Gonzalez, permanent legal resident in Minneapolis. Thanks a lot, Ricardo.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick got the attention of the nation when he refused to stand for the national anthem before a football game last week. Kaepernick says he'll keep on sitting to protest police brutality and the treatment of people of color in America. The reaction, most of it offended and disapproving, some of it racist, especially on social media. Some fans burned his jersey in counter-protest, a move like Kaepernick's refusal to stand. That's a form of speech that got noticed. Many veterans did not approve of Kaepernick's protest, but perhaps surprisingly, a lot of them did. Veterans took to social media this week saying things like, "I might not agree with Colin Kaepernick, but I agree that I defended everyone's freedom of speech." They used the hashtag Veterans for Kaepernick. Asha Castleberry was a captain in the U.S. Army. She served in the Middle East from 2012 to 2015. She's also African-American, and she says Kaepernick's protest spoke to her as a veteran of color.
Initially became a controversy as being perceived as being somewhat disrespectful to the American flag and to a certain extent to the veterans community. But it was definitely a lot more deeper than that. To me, it was more of the issues that have been developing for quite some time, especially recently, that have been more covert with regards to social, economic, and political issues for people of color, especially for African Americans.
So to many veterans, on the one hand, this was sort of an affront, a refusal to stand for the national anthem. But it sounds like for many of you, and I think you're including yourself in this, it was a pretty salient and loud way to bring some of these issues to the national attention.
Absolutely. It was definitely a way to have more of a national dialogue about the injustices or issues that have been going on for quite some time in the African American community. And I must say it has been definitely more of a concern due to the fact with the police brutality issues, the economic disparity going on, as well as during the political presidential campaign season. We even have our Republican nominee who has normalized covert racism remarks. So it's just been a wild season for these kind of discussions.
So you've spent a lot of time among a lot of soldiers, soldiers of color and white soldiers as well. Put yourself back in Kuwait, if you could. And I know this happened while you were stateside, but when troops overseas see a protest like this, how is that digested when they're in theater and they see something like this in the NFL, which I'm sure they're watching if they have some downtime going on?
What we like to do overseas, we love to watch sports. I tell you, that is a morale booster.
Yeah.
So immediately when you see something like that, for some soldiers, it may be a concern because you're defending your country and you're like, what's going on? But for others, especially for people of color, they might see beyond that to where, okay, I understand the issues in people of color communities to where it's not about necessarily disrespecting our country or the American flag, but it's a way to resonate the message about issues that are going on in our community, and we need more national dialogue about this.
And that makes me wonder what your own experience has been like coming back from a war back to your own country, where clearly these things are going on and they're a concern to you. Police brutality, income inequality, violence, and all these issues you're concerned about. You've had this experience fighting for the country and then coming home.
Yes, actually, my concerns kind of developed when I was overseas, I think about in 2014, where the Black Lives Matter movement actually started coming up. And I was actually in the Middle East when Trayvon Martin was shot. So that was definitely a concern. And then a lot of these different incidents kind of developed on my way back home. So I came home where police brutality was definitely a concern for people of color, especially African Americans. So, yes, it's just been a very challenging moment for me coming from home and then watching this going on in our country.
Did it ever make you wonder what you were fighting for or whether you were fighting for the thing that you thought you were fighting for?
No, not at all. You know, outside of this country, we have a lot of national security threats that are emerging and that are definitely threatening to our sovereignty or just our country, period. So defending our country from those emerging national security threats like ISIS, to me, that makes a lot of sense, especially for the fact that the United States is the best country in the world. So it's worth it. I never questioned my stance on why I'm defending this country, because unfortunately, in other countries, they don't have the kind of freedom that we have.
You were out in the desert helping fight against ISIS, and ISIS has proven themselves as a feature to be the enemies of free expression and of protest. And it seems to me that that's pretty salient here for somebody like you. Like Colin Kaepernick's protest or not, there are a lot of places in the world where you pay for your life if you don't stand up.
Yes, exactly. And that is such a different world. But he's making a sacrifice, too, because Colin is actually mentioning things that are very sensitive to many Americans. When we talk about racism, it's a very sensitive topic, but it's still going on. And it's something that in order for this country to be better or to be greater, we have to know how this affects other communities and what are some solutions that we could bring to these communities that have been marginalized or have been hurt from racism. And it takes the entire country to realize this and move forward with a solution.
Now, I know that you vets talk a lot amongst yourselves when you're not in the media talking to people like me. What have your conversations been like with fellow former soldiers who are white when they talk to you and you talk to them about this?
Honestly, I haven't spoke to that many vets about this because this just happened. But for the most part, what I've seen on social media is that they understand what he stands for. And these are some Caucasian veterans that have spoke out for him and supported what he did. And they see that beyond just disrespecting the American flag, they understand that he's trying to defend the liberties, the life and freedom of a certain group of people, especially people of color. And we understand that because we all served and all of us see us as human beings, as soldiers who wear the same color. Not, okay, you're white, you're black, you're Spanish, or you're Asian. We all have a unique bond because we share a very unique experience.
Asha Castleberry, U.S. Army veteran, served in Kuwait, Jordan, and Iraq. Captain Castleberry, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Colin Kaepernick's protest definitely got a lot of you talking. Robert on Facebook writes, well, he sure got America talking about this, didn't he? Many don't agree with him, but we should all be grateful for this one American freedom of expression that all of us fight for every day in every protest and in every war. Silencing one's opinions or retaliation is not the answer to his actions. Let us all remember that this is America, where the freedom to think for oneself is sacred and should be defended by all. And Nick asks, ignoring the anthem is a disservice? What about the crumbling VA, low military pay, the disappearing benefits? That's all fine and dandy. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE. You can join this conversation at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, once one of the most controversial laws in America, is not doing well. Several health insurance companies have pulled out of state exchanges. They're citing rising costs, fewer people signing up, and the fact that they're losing money. 20 million Americans do have new private health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Millions more have qualified for Medicaid, expanded under the law. But for those covered under the exchanges, premiums are rising by as much as 10% in seven states. Larry Levitt is a senior vice president for the Kaiser Family Foundation. He says the faltering exchanges are a concern, but they're not the end of Obamacare.
The main reason insurers are leaving is they're not making money. An insurer that's not profiting on Obamacare business is not going to stick around in this market for long. The reason they're not making money, one is that not enough healthy people have signed up. You know, Obamacare guaranteed insurance for people who are sick, people with pre-existing conditions, and they signed up as soon as they could. The challenge has been getting healthy people to kind of balance that out. And then the second thing is, you know, this is a competitive market. In fact, this market has proven to be even more competitive than people thought. And some insurers are making money, but others, particularly these big national insurers like Aetna, aren't. I mean, they're just having trouble competing.
Why haven't they attracted enough healthier patients? First of all, does healthier mean younger when it comes to insurance? And could they get more of them if the penalties were worse, let's say?
Generally, younger people are healthier, although the real key here is getting healthy people of all ages. The Affordable Care Act built in carrots and sticks to try and get healthy folks to sign up. The carrots are the subsidies available to low and middle income people that lower their premiums. The stick is the so-called individual mandate. You know, you face penalties if you remain uninsured. And, you know, there was a big debate when Congress was considering the Affordable Care Act, whether the subsidies were big enough to make insurance affordable and whether the penalties under the individual mandate were big enough to nudge people into signing up. And, you know, I think what we may be finding is both are issues, that the subsidies may not be enough and the individual mandate may not be quite strong enough either.
And so now for patients or for people who carry this kind of insurance, they're going to see premiums going up faster this year than they went up last year. Especially people in rural areas are going to find in many cases they only have one choice of plan. None of these are good signs. Are the exchanges in trouble? Is it time to say that?
There are red flags. There are certainly red flags. You know, there are parts of the country, particularly rural areas, where there are going to be fewer plans available. In fact, now 31% of counties in 2017 look like they'll only have one insurer available, mostly in rural areas. And the premiums are going up faster. So, you know, a lot hinges on how the next open enrollment period goes. Enrollment for Obamacare plans in 2017 starts November 1st, right before the election. And if things go well, you know, if more people sign up, then I think a lot of these current concerns will fade away and insurers will feel pretty good about the future. But if enrollment starts to drop, then I think you may see more insurers exiting and a big debate next year about how to fix these exchanges.
And fixing the exchanges is the next big question, clearly a call for the next president. Donald Trump says he would work to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It's a familiar position for Republicans. Hillary Clinton would want to improve it, a familiar position for a Democrat. But improving it at this point means what? Does it mean increasing those subsidies? What else?
You know, if you look at what Hillary Clinton has proposed, she suggested, as you said, improving the subsidies, you know, giving bigger subsidies to low and middle income people. She's also talked about a national outreach campaign to encourage more people to sign up, since there's still a lot of confusion out there about the help that's available or the penalties people face if they don't sign up. And Clinton has proposed a public option plan, a public insurance plan that would be available in areas where there's inadequate competition. Republicans have been unanimous in their calls for repealing the law, which certainly does fix the exchanges in a sense, but would also leave a lot of people uninsured, since the ACA has covered 20 million people already. There are definitely ways to fix the exchanges. The question is whether our political system can actually come together and figure out what those fixes are.
And those political incentives are going to be really important. I mean, what are the chances, if Hillary Clinton is elected president, that Republicans would sense, you know, a mandate on her part and would want to participate in fixes?
So far, we're 6 years into Obamacare, and there really hasn't been any kind of normal discussion over how to tweak the law, whether that's tweaking it in a liberal direction or a conservative direction. You know, we've been stuck in this stalemate between either repealing it or keeping it as is.
There are 11 million people in these exchanges that are having some trouble right now that we're talking about. We should point out that this is a vast, vast minority when you compare it to the 150 million people who still get their health insurance at their work. And we're not talking about the same group of people.
No, I mean, you know, there have been these headlines about Aetna pulling out of the exchanges, United pulling out of the exchanges, you know, massive premium increases of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% in some cases. And if I didn't do this for a living, I'd look at those headlines and I'd be worried if I had insurance on my job through Aetna or United. But the reality is we're talking about a very small percentage of people with insurance. You know, the vast majority of Americans get insurance through their employer, through Medicare, through Medicaid, and none of this instability we're seeing now in the exchanges affects them.
People like to use this term death spiral for failing exchanges. If they start to do poorly, they get fewer people signing up, and then the whole thing spirals from there as the insurance company makes less and less money. You mentioned this next enrollment period. If it doesn't go well, is that the beginning of a death spiral?
I think the risk of an actual death spiral where premiums get completely out of control is very low. And the reason is these subsidies. 85% of the people in the exchanges are getting a subsidy from the federal government, and that subsidy cushions them from premium increases, especially if they're willing to switch to a cheaper plan. So I think a risk of a death spiral is really low, but there are some states that are in trouble. And it's important to remember that insurance risk is pooled at a state level, meaning that things are going well in California as they are. That doesn't really help Tennessee or Arizona, where things are going poorly. So, you know, if things do get out of control, it's likely to be in some specific states. It won't be a kind of nationwide problem.
Larry Levitt, Senior Vice President for the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thanks, Larry.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The summer recess is over in the UK. Newly elected British Prime Minister Theresa May met with cabinet ministers on Wednesday to talk about a path forward 2 months after the Brexit vote that surprised the EU, the UK, and the rest of the world.
We'll be looking at the next steps that we need to take, but we'll also be looking at the opportunities that are now open to us as we forge a new role for the UK in the world. There's no second referendum, no attempts to sort of stay in the EU by the back door. Yeah. We're actually going to deliver on this.
Theresa May talks there about forging a new role for the UK in the world. But our next guest sees things a little differently. How many lives will be lost to them? My hunger means it's way bigger than the pain that I place on the CD. If I told you all the truth, would you really believe me? It's still my hunger means it's still my hunger means it. Akala is a hip-hop artist, he's an academic, and he was a Remain campaigner in the UK. His lyrics talk about social divides, poverty, international injustice, and his commentary about the Brexit vote have led some people to call for him to run for prime minister. But Akala says this political moment is about more than the next election for him. It's about a sense of loss around the world that causes some groups to target others.
Firstly, just to be clear, I wasn't necessarily absolutely pro-Remain. I just think as a nation, our media and the people that led the Brexit campaign chose to focus on issues, A, that were very little to do with the EU, and B, kind of created a really xenophobic climate in the country. And because of that, the fallout has been kind of really a barrage of racial abuse, even attacks sometimes. People thought that, you know, all of a sudden the next day all the immigrants would leave and go back to Europe. So what it told Europe and the world about Britain as a country, that we think not only we're so much better than people in the global south, in Africa and Asia, we think we're much better than the rest of Europe. And being frank, as a nation, we have, on many indices, some of the worst outcomes in the EU. So, for example, we lock up our population in prison about twice the rate the Germans do. We have almost the lowest educational attainment in the entire EU, despite being one of the richest countries. So we have a lot of problems as a country. Rather than dealing with them, we've kind of blamed all these people coming from elsewhere.
You're staring at me while you say this, and I can't help thinking about the United States, a country with all of the wealth and yet not the highest educational attainment, that's in the throes of blaming others for its problems, that locks up people at a much higher rate than anyone comparable. Yep. It's like looking in a mirror when I'm talking to you right now.
And Britain has very much economically, culturally, politically pushed itself more towards the States than towards the European model. And the outcomes of that have been predictable. I mean, 2 million people last year in Britain were living on food banks in one of the richest countries on earth. That should embarrass people. Instead of it embarrassing people and working to make their country better, they think it's the foreigners' fault, or at least that's what the media was telling them. And that really, almost the whole of Brexit was fought around this idea of immigration. And ironically, as several actual scholars pointed out, the EU has no control over Britain's immigration policy.
You've talked about and you've rapped about growing up on the dole yourself, being a poor kid in Britain, what it meant to be on public assistance.
Starved, sleeping in a tracksuit, gas meter running out, electric cut off as well, candles lighting up the house. Looking in my mother's eyes, I see how she feels. The strain and the pain of just paying bills that ain't real. And that's how I grew, like so many more.
And now flash forward to a moment where you're one of the people in the middle of this debate where all of the subtext about that is kind of coming around on itself. It's an interesting place to be.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the layers of stupidity around it. So, for example, my grandparents, so on my dad's side, came from the Caribbean in the post-war years. So all of the European powers, the French and the British particularly, had people from their Commonwealth fight for them in World War II. Kind of inconceivable that war would have been won without their colonies. Post-World War II, all the destruction that's been brought on Britain, people from the colonies and France were invited to help rebuild the country, to build things that actually poor people benefited massively from. For similar reasons to what has occurred in this kind of Brexit era, we were treated in a very hostile manner. There were basically a lot of kind of violent persecution for those early decades. So if you look at the way the stats panned out after the campaign and they analysed voting patterns, all of the places, ironically, where there are migrant populations, people voted to stay. All the places where there are not migrant populations, other than Scotland and Northern Ireland, where there are not huge migrant populations, voted to leave. So ironically, this fear of immigration was highest in places where there are no immigrants. After all of that, the people that were in charge of the campaign, Mr. Farage, Mr. Johnson, Michael Gove and others, have sort of basically kind of left the house to burn and said, you lot get on with it. But we've not actually left the EU. That's the thing. It was just a public indication to the government.
Somebody out there has called for you to run for prime minister. A real elected prime minister, Akala, not an unelected prime minister who's been installed.
Well, I think people think that, you know, someone like me who's young, from the background I'm from, kind of understands issues for young working class people in the UK. I don't know if change comes in a society from within the hallowed halls of political power. I think often changes in society have come, big changes, from people outside the hallowed halls of power putting pressure on those in power. Because I can't say I would never, ever. I don't know what the future
holds. I was
going
to say, you got awfully serious when I asked that question. You were supposed to laugh it off and say, I'm an artist. I wouldn't run for office.
Yeah,
you did not say that.
No, I don't ever see it being something I would attempt to do. You just never know what would happen in future. I think me being involved more formally in some sort of politics, perhaps, me attempting to become the Prime Minister of Britain or the Mayor of London or anything of that nature, I sincerely doubt it.
Donald Trump said on Twitter, soon they will be calling me Mr. Brexit. What do you think he meant by that?
I have no idea. I can only assume he was trying to associate himself ideologically with this kind of fervent nationalism that fed Brexit. People who don't know the history of England and the history of, if I can put it that way, this kind of British nationalist, really kind of psychotic identity, in the sense that on the one hand, Britain was the first global empire. On the other hand, there's a certain section of British society that likes to pretend that it doesn't know any of that. And I do think there's a sense of this, a loss of hegemony, that feels like persecution. When you're used to having everything, having, you know, 80% of everything can feel like persecution, when in reality you still have 80% of everything.
It's Union Jacks on a lot of flags.
On a hell of a lot of flags around the globe, right? You have a similar strain of that in America.
It's the exact same thing going on here. It's not widespread, but it is an important and vocal part of Donald Trump's support right now, which is it's nostalgia for the way the country used to be, but also a victimhood built into that.
I think it's also, I don't want to sound like it's all doom and gloom. There is a lot of progressive stuff, particularly in the major cities, going on around this loud noise of Brexit. Not everyone's seduced by nonsense, right? There are lots of people, just like there are in America, who believe in respecting other human beings, believe in working for a better world and a better future. But it is difficult because there is a lot of noise saying, actually, no, it's better to hate other people. So I think that you always have in societies this dialogue. And I think the way I've always tried to approach music is as social commentary, is someone who is inspired by actually Jimi Hendrix or Marvin Gaye or James Brown or John Lennon or so many other different people who've used their voice and their platform to tell us about the world and to inform us about injustice. Think of someone like Billie Holiday, you know, singing songs like Strange Fruit back then. And so I think the role that art plays, the way that art can speak truth to power, the way that art's ability to communicate very complicated ideas in a compact, quick, easy to digest form is one of the things that's so powerful and beautiful about it, and one of the things that really made me want to be a musician. It's like I see myself as part musician, but also part, you know, folk historian. So I think musicians have a role in articulating some of those things.
That's Akala, hip-hop artist, Remain campaigner, cultural crusader, talking about life in the UK after the passing of Brexit and the role of art, culture, and multiculturalism in the UK's future, and also in our future, too, here in the US. He'll be touring the United States in November. Thanks for being here, man.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. Silver linings to global warming. Well, if you're a biologist, maybe. The warming climate has caused Greenland's ice sheet to melt, of course, losing trillions of tons of ice in the last 4 years. That melt has uncovered the oldest fossils ever seen, though, microbial mats that lived 3.7 billion years ago. Australian geologists announced the discovery in the journal Nature, and if confirmed, it would push the fossil record back more than 200 million years deeper into Earth's history than where it is now. So as I said, maybe a silver lining to global warming, maybe. Follow me on Twitter if you like. I'm at Todd Zwillick. I always like to get your replies. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.